You are listening to the Legal Design Podcast. My name is Henna Tolvanen.
And I am Nina Toivonen. This is Legal Talk Out of the Box.
In this episode, our guest is Andrea Lindblom from Sweden. Andrea works at Helsingborg District Court as Chief of Administration. Today, we talk about legal design and digitalization at courts. Andrea is a true pioneer of applying design thinking to the legal work at courts. It's so great to have you with us, Andrea. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Henna and Nina.
It's great to have you with us, Andrea. How is it going? How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. We have been, I've had a terrible cough now for a few weeks. Oh. That's been really annoying, but I think I'm starting to get better. So I'm looking very much forward to spring and more light and warmer temperatures.
Oh, we as well. It's good to hear. How would you introduce yourself and what have you been up to lately, project-wise?
I am a lawyer. I studied law at the university in Lund, in Sweden, and I live in Malmö. I work at the district court in Helsingborg, like you said, as the administrative chief, and I have had my job for about 6 years, I think. And I found a drawing made by Margaret Hagen about three or four years ago. And that was my first encounter with legal design. Then I have been very passionately interested. And now it's like the most interesting thing in my life. And I love the people and I love everything about it. And I want to spend as much time as possible in talking about it and doing it and experimenting with it. Because I think it has great potential and it's so interesting.
That sounds great. And this is our love project.
Oh, as well. Yes, definitely. You mentioned that your journey with legal design started with finding a picture made by Margaret Hagen. So what happened next after that? Can you tell us a bit about...
That was a drawing that I have been showing to people, so many people now, so many times. But it was from a courts technology conference in the United States from 2017, I think. And she made a drawing about how courts could become more innovative. Right then we were thinking a lot about digitalization and how digitalization was affecting the courts. And we were really starting to realize and had been realizing for some time that things are changing very quickly and we need to get going. We need to start changing. We need to work differently to be more proactive and leaning into change instead of always sort of trying to resist and then stumbling along. Yeah. So when I found that drawing and came across she managed really to capture the essence of courts trying to struggle with becoming more innovative and adapting more quickly. So I still pick that drawing up from time to time because I think it's so great.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
And I love that we all have different paths into legal design. This is great. And you mentioned that you love legal design. What other things does it mean for you?
Well, for me, legal design means putting users at the center. And it means making sure you're solving the right problem. And it means working interdisciplinary with people who know stuff that you don't. And just these quite simple mindsets, change of mindsets, are basically the most interesting and exciting things that I have come across during my career, because I think these are completely different mindsets than the ones that I had been trained in at law school. They seem so natural but they're not for lawyers. I think lawyers often put ourselves at the center, and tend to forget that we don't exist for ourselves, but for the people or for the users we're serving.
I love your enthusiasm, and it all sounds great. And working outside the court and from an outsider point of view, changing how courts work seems, well, hard work. And courts tend to have low tolerance for failure. But on the contrary, legal design and design thinking are failure friendly. And how do you combine these two worlds and two mindsets? There's the court world where you can't make any mistakes, and then there's the design thinking world where you can actually make mistakes and learn from them.
Yeah, I think you are absolutely right when you say that courts are not very failure friendly, because we're not, and maybe we never can be failure friendly, or we could never say that we are. We embrace failure. But
good,
I mean,
point.
There is something about this time we're living in right now that courts are really struggling to keep up with a rapid development. And when things are changing as fast as they are today, we need to get used to not having any experts or previous experience to listen to. And this is new for us, because at least I have been trained at law school to look backwards. How did we do this before? How did they do this in the 1970s? What did the Supreme Court say in the 1960s? Well, you can't, it's good to look back. I like history too. But you can't find the right answers to our questions today by only looking backwards. So instead, I think it's quite urgent that courts need to be have an open mindset towards, for example, new technology and new ways of doing things. And we need to find ways to experiment lightly, gently, because it's much better for us to fail small and early in a process than to fail massively and very late. I think Cat Moon is always talking about this humble curiosity, and I think she is so right in that with humble curiosity you can come a long way, but by having an attitude that I don't know where we're going to end up, but let's give it a try, let's experiment, let's listen to what we can do and see, because the opposite would be to think it's someone else's problem to fix the future and our future solutions for us, and then we won't have any possibility to affect the future or how our future workplace or court is going to be.
Great points.
Yeah, we have to.
And very eye-opening.
Yeah, we have to be proactive instead of reactive.
Yeah.
Legal procedures, at least in Finland, are known for being overlong and expensive, and which is a big problem for access to justice. And it has been fairly criticized that most people, because of that, they cannot afford court proceedings, and those many private disputes are either solved outside of courts or people just are left without any resolutions. And in Finland, some have suggested that courts should just start cutting legal costs more actively, but others think that the whole legal proceeding system should be redesigned and looked as a whole. And you can probably guess which of these options is our favorite. All that redesigning and systemic thinking would, however, require 100% participation from the courts that often have limited budgets and already overworked staff. And this might not be the best starting point for innovation. So from your experience, Andrea, how to encourage judges and other staff at courts to find new ways of working and doing, being more innovative?
Well, I think it's it has been quite useful for me to be try and be very enthusiastic, because people want to come along on your journey, I would believe, if you are enthusiastic and you are optimistic, and if you're more like, come with me, this is going to be great, instead of, you know, you have to come along, otherwise you will fail. You will fail because people like to be on the winning team, and they like to get compliments that they're so future friendly or whatever. So I have been trying to encourage my colleagues and the people I work with in taking a more active role when it comes to creating our future. And because if you participate, if you volunteer as a lab rat, you can really also affect the outcome much more than if you just continue to stay away from every development project. So we have been asking ourselves, do we want to be a part of building our future, or is someone else going to do that for us? And I think if you ask that question, many people want to be a part of building our future. And I also believe very much in, like I said earlier, in working interdisciplinary, working with people that know stuff you don't. And I mean, in Sweden, we could, and probably everywhere, I think we would gain very much from really listening to people's experiences of the courts. To my knowledge, not much research has been done during the last years on user experiences at court, or if people actually do understand what we write in our judgments or information letters, or how do people who have been to trial, did they understand what was going on? Did it take reasonable time? Did they feel respected? And I think it would be very interesting to dig deeper into these questions to know a bit more about where are we standing today? Are things okay? Are they bad? Mm-hmm. Could they get better? And what do the people say who come to court? Because we exist for them. The courts exist for them and for the country, basically.
Yeah, good points. I think in the legal world, we often tend to think that emotions and such experiences, they're not legal, so we shouldn't pay attention to those. That's just how people react, and we think that they're somehow disconnected to the outcome or what's mm-hmm. happening. But going to court and litigating and all that dispute resolution, it's something, it's a once in a lifetime experience for general citizens.
Yeah.
How do you think, or do you think that judges and court staff understand these emotions and how they kind of address these, you know, court proceedings, or if at all?
I think that most judges are very well aware mm-hmm. of the fact that the situation is quite uncomfortable. I mean, in a good situation, it's uncomfortable. In a bad situation, it feels like a nightmare, I guess, mm-hmm. for people to support. But I really think that most judges are very well aware of this. And I think that many judges also do what they can to make people feel trust in the process and in them as judges. This is what I think. And because this is so important And I would really love to see more solid research that we can trust from different countries in user experiences from courts, where you have actually talked to the people who come, and not just in their professional roles, but normal people, everyone. And I mean, there are ways that judges try to make it easier for people. For example, trying to use a plain language is one common thing that usually pops up when we discuss these matters. And that of course makes a big difference. If you don't understand what the judge says or what's going on, that's problematic. And I think many judges also are good at asking people, do you understand, or does this need further explanation? Where you actually, I mean, you can't, maybe a judge can't be extremely helpful, but I believe there is some kind of way that you can act that people feel trust in you without sort of doubting your objectivity
or neutrality
as a judge.
Because I think that's one of the problem that, well, I don't have experience of being a judge myself, but this objectivity question that you have to stay in the role and also at the same time give a sense that you are objective and look at the case from like an outsider point of view, but at the same time, there should be like an environment where people can feel a bit more relaxed and feel heard and understood. So this might be a problem to issue in the future when designing court proceedings to be more human-centered.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. And I don't think I even realized how differently people can actually feel about going to court. My friend is a doctor, and she was witnessing in this in one of the cases, and she felt that it was so hard to be at court, even as a professional, trying to tell the medical side of the story. And she felt like she was there being accused and her professionalism was criticized, and she ended up going crying home. So that's when I realized that, okay, there might be some issues there.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. I mean, every person has their own experience, and I would just wish that instead of sort of guessing what people feel, the question is so important that it deserves to be looked at properly, to know what the situation is like and where we should be going next.
Yeah, that's true. So if we think about dispute resolution, I think corporations often choose alternative dispute resolution and, well, especially arbitration over court. And for corporations, ADR might be faster and they might feel that they will get better understanding in ADR instances because they can contribute to choosing the arbitrators and mediators. And they might be able to choose professionals with in-depth knowledge about the topic of their dispute. And then on the other hand, we might have thought that ADR for private people is too risky and way too expensive, and they are almost always recommended to go to public courts. However, nowadays many courts are understaffed and the waiting for the hearing might be in years and not months. And private people often need professional help from lawyers, and that might become a huge burden financially. It seems like there are some challenges to serve both private people and corporations at courts. Also, there seems to be some dissatisfaction towards dispute resolution in courts. How might we tackle these issues? Is it possible to redesign the processes to meet the different needs of different types of court clients? or should justice be blind about the different needs in terms of equality?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. And I know that we have some judges here who like to discuss this and have very good and interesting points about this. But what I think, I just have some few thoughts concerning dispute resolution and courts. I think definitely that it's not reasonable if you have small claims dispute that you should have to travel for hours to go to court. I don't think that's reasonable, especially not after this pandemic when everyone has been sitting in video meetings and doing their entire careers through Zoom or whatever platform. So I think it's quite urgent to start exploring virtual digital dispute resolution in the public sector, like not as a private alternative, but like they have been experimenting with now for some years in British Columbia, where they have this online dispute resolution tribunal, where they have small claims and I think car claims and some other kinds of claims that they handle completely online. And I mean, that's a part of the justice system, that solution. And their website looks amazing and they have a solution explorer. And I would be very interested to for the courts in the Scandinavian countries, for example, to explore that kind of road, to be open to test other means of dispute resolution using digital tools as an alternative to traditional court-based sitting in a physical room that way, because I don't think that's the future if we want to have small claims disputes at the courts much longer.
Yeah, exactly. That makes sense.
I mean, one objection that normally comes when we talk about this is the principle that all court proceedings need to be transparent. And in Sweden, I mean, probably in Finland too, you can basically come and visit all trials or all proceedings that are held at the court. And that is, of course, something that needs to be thought about carefully. How do we solve this? Because the transparency aspect is, of course, very important for trust in the judicial system and so on. But I don't think that we can demand that people should travel for hours in their cars or by plane or however to go to a physical court when it comes to civil disputes. I don't think that we can do that much longer.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, well, in Finland and in Sweden, the distances can be quite long.
They can.
So if you live somewhere up north, you might have to travel literally for hours just to get your dispute resolved.
Yes, but I think there is a tendency that when this matter is being discussed, someone always says that, well, we can't have digital criminal trials. How would you feel if it was a trial that concerned rape or sexual abuse, for example? How would you like to have to be a victim of crime and sit at a Zoom trial? But I mean, we shouldn't discuss the most serious kinds of cases, the most extreme, because I don't think anyone thinks it's suitable to have those kinds of trials online. Maybe not in very many years, but there are. We don't only have these very serial criminal cases. We have many other kinds of cases that where it shouldn't be too controversial to start experimenting.
Exactly, and that was a good point that not all the cases are very serious and very no. hard, but most of them are actually, well, a bit smaller, and then
they
it would make sense to redesign the process for them at least. Well, I think that in civil cases, going to court might feel, at least for some people, that it is only about arguing and fighting and winning and losing instead of actually solving the conflict so that the both parties can live their lives happily ever after. And well, at least in Finland, a lot of courts are also offering mediation to solve conflicts these days. Do you think that there should be a larger cultural change at courts towards the softer conflict resolution? And could legal design be helpful in this?
I don't want to pretend to be an expert here. But I think there has already been a cultural change at many courts towards this softer conflict resolution, where mediation is a natural part of the process. And most judges that work here in Helsingborg are very interested in mediation and dispute resolution without a trial. So I definitely believe that's good for everyone. And legal design, I'm sure, could be helpful in using, for example, I know some judges use visuals sometimes to explain the conflicts or to help the parties get an overview over the things that they disagree on and so on. So absolutely.
To talk about practicing legal design in courts, what can we do differently in courts? In Finland, there have been some projects to redesign the invitation and other documents and letters sent out to clients to be more understandable. But what else can you design in courts other than just the paperwork?
I think one of my dream projects would be to have a really good information designer to work with our written documents and, of course, also our communication online on our webpage. That would be really, really exciting, I think, because we have very recently started with, I think we have now maybe 2 or 3 e-services, and there has been no designer near these solutions. And I think that would be very interesting to have an information designer or an interaction designer to be part of these projects from the very beginning and make them really user-friendly and easy to use. So that's one thing, like you said, working with the language and information design. Another thing is a process design, like we were talking a little bit about just now, before designing the process. If we would start experimenting with online dispute resolution or digital dispute resolution, and how, I mean, maybe we shouldn't just take the normal process and put it in a Zoom call. Maybe we should redesign that process and make it work really well for that other format. That's another idea that I have been thinking about. And also what I was really struggling with in 2019 and also 2019 mostly, was how we work when we develop new solutions, like basically project design, where I believe that this whole idea of working interdisciplinary is so important, that we figure that out and that we work like that and not work in silos like we have done forever, because it just doesn't work doing things like that anymore. So I would say process design and information design and project design.
What kind of cases you have had or projects in Helsingborg?
Right now, I don't have very much going on, I must say, because my boss has just got a new job. So she is doing her, my ex-boss is doing her first day at her new job at the Court of Appeals in Malmö, where she's now the president. That's really cool.
Wow, cool.
So we're waiting for a new boss. And and unfortunately, like I was saying to you before we started recording, I think that too much has been put on hold when it comes to projects and development projects and things that we have been working with.
Because of the corona, yeah. But
since the pandemic,
yeah,
I think too many people have just put a pause on and believe that the right thing is to wait. And maybe I'm really impatient, but I'm starting to become really frustrated. We had in 2019, we talked about a lot about legal design, and we went to Finland to the Legal Design Summit, which was a huge deal for me and for my previous boss too. So I still get nice emails now and then from people from the Courts Administration Authority saying like, you know, we have started experimenting now with legal design thanks to you, and it works quite well. And you know, maybe things aren't always happening as fast as we want, but we'll get there. And that makes me really happy. I mean, I have really learned too that change takes time. That's just the way it is. I don't like it, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
And courts are like, they're such an important part of the system, the legal system. And I think it's not only about the courts. I think the ministries of justice need to start to lead the progress and make a reality check. But I think governments today are so much struggling with the corona and how to handle the pandemic that not enough attention is being put to the side effects. I think we have to just, like you said.
Absolutely. And I mean, also, you will never win an election if you will not win elections by saying, I'm going to make courts more user friendly, because it's not a reality question.
Yeah,
and that's also another reason for us who are a part of the judicial system and the judicial industry to make it happen ourselves, because we probably know where we would like to go and at least a little bit about what needs to happen, and no one else does, really.
And that's why I really think that civil servants, like the people who work for the court, who are not politicians or who don't have to think of how sustainable their career is if they say this or that, but have a really important role in putting forward the progress, because they can really do big changes and make it happen if they have the courage and support from their superiors for making the change.
And I think even if this is not a political question, but we actually invited the Minister of Justice twice to Helsingborg District Court and told him about our projects and what we were working on.
Oh, wow,
and,
that's cool.
He told me to keep up the good job and continue. And I take that as a signal to continue and strive towards the future.
Oh, yeah,
that's great feedback.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, more of that, please.
Yeah.
Exactly.
This might be a bit funny question. Often the rulings are written in legalese and might be unclear for court subjects. And even after the court decision, people might be unaware of, okay, how did this outcome happen and what's behind this? And constantly in media, we see discussions and articles about court decisions that just doesn't seem to make sense for, let's say, normal people who don't have a lawyer training themselves. And then the lawyers just reach out to help and explain what this and that principle means.
Yeah.
Do you have ideas what could be done to this? Should there be like non-legalese versions of rulings for real people? Like there is this legal version and then there's this simple language, easy to understand version with pictures. Like when I was studying in Laura, the legal design program, I remember that we were making comics and poems and video clips about court rulings to clarify the main point of each case, and so that people would get, okay, what makes the difference in this highest court ruling, for example. So
yeah,
what do you think?
I mean, you're absolutely right that this discussion on the use of language and plain language has been a big discussion in Sweden for at least 10, maybe even 15 years. So I would say that most judges nowadays, I think, are quite aware of this challenge. And earlier in the early days, it was considered to be a good thing to write legalese and complicated. Whereas now, I think it's almost the opposite. There are many excellent judges who are very good at writing their rulings in quite plain language. And it is also, I think there has been a culture shift during recent years that it's considered to be very positive to use visuals, for example, in your rulings, if you can use if you need to include a map in your ruling, for example, you should include the map and not describe in words the map. So I think there has been quite a positive development the last years, and it has definitely been discussed very much in Sweden. And as one example, the district court in southern Stockholm, Södertörn, they won an award in Sweden for their plain language work, and they were awarded this award for a specific ruling that they had written, you know, with which was really a joy to read. So I think there has been a culture shift from you are only a good judge if you write really complicated and difficult to you are not a good judge if no one understands what you say. But then, I mean, lawyers, we love the language. We love these terms. I think we can all agree on that certain words are easily to replace with a simpler version that means the same thing. But unfortunately, that doesn't really go for all terms. There are some legal terms, quite a few actually, that aren't easily replaced because they have a very specific meaning. And how to go about with them, I don't know. But that's a tricky question, and it would be really fun to have a discussion and mention some examples of these words that you just can't seem to get rid of because we just have to have them.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it's safe to say that we can redesign court information and the processes and even the language that we use But Andrea, do you think that we should redesign the justice system so that there would be not that many court cases in general?
Oh, that's a massive question. I wouldn't want to be responsible for redesigning the whole justice system at once, because that redesigning probably needs to happen in small steps, one step at a time, or several steps at a time, but maybe not led by the same person. But I think that having putting users at the center and being more curious and really considering all these legal design mindsets can create a small revolution. And I would love to see that revolution happen gently, because I think redesigning the whole justice system might be too big of a challenge. But I believe more in daring to experiment more at a small scale and working interdisciplinary, I think.
Exactly. That's a great point that, well, change takes for a long time, but we can start doing it by small steps.
Yeah.
So, well, I understood that you are really keen on technology at courts. You mentioned this conference in the beginning that you got interested in legal design. I was just Googling things and dispute resolution. And then I found this, that European Commission provides an online dispute resolution platform just to make online shopping safer and fairer through access to quality dispute resolution tools. And in other parts of the world, there are some really interesting ODR projects to help people solve their disputes raised from, for example, rental agreements. From your point of view, should courts start to provide dispute resolution online? Well, actually, you mentioned that earlier, that there are some interesting projects already, but what should be considered and what might be the benefits or risks on?
Well, like I said before, I really think we should start experimenting with this. I'm sure that we could agree that certain kinds of disputes would be quite suitable to try and experiment with, for example, small claims. And maybe car insurance cases or that kind of, those kinds of cases too. The benefits, of course, is cost reduction and making it much easier for people to get access to justice. Although I am aware of, not everyone has a smartphone or a laptop or is a natural born internet guru. So we also have to remember that not everyone will be comfortable with online dispute resolution, and it's very important not to forget about those people. I mean, elderly people or people with different challenges in life. A risk that I can see is that we pick something just because it's new and cool and miss to consider that it has to fit all users and not just users with full laptop and smartphone capability, for example. But if you ask me if we should start experimenting with online dispute resolution, different tools and how we do that, my answer would definitely be yes.
Great. And that's a good point that we need to remember that not everybody is born with the mobile phone on their hands.
No.
And we need to remember that those people still exist.
Yeah.
Because I actually look at my parents who are not that old, but they represent a different generation. And when it comes to, for example, online banking, everything requires a smartphone. And especially my dad is like, he is really confused from time to time with everything happening with the phone.
Yeah, we just got my grandmother, who is 90 years, her first iPhone. And you can just imagine the amount of calls that many relatives have gotten. But I mean, seeing on FaceTime with half her face and smiling and being so sick of Corona and COVID-19 is really lovely, even if it's been super complicated for her to understand the difference between the green SMS app and the phone app.
That's a great story.
Artificial intelligence has been a hot topic also in legal for quite some time now. And I think there's also been some discussion about using artificial intelligence in court decision making. Do you think, or what are your thoughts about how far in Scandinavia or in Northern, in Europe we are from using artificial intelligence in courts, and what kind of benefits or possibilities that could bring to designing the court work different or more efficient?
I think we're very far away from that still, extremely far away, I would say, because there are so many complicated aspects on using AI and court data and data protection and internet security. And it's just, I mean, the court's data is quite sensitive, and we have lots of rules about how that can be used. And the answer to almost all questions concerning can we use your data to do XX is no, you can't. You can't have our data and you can't use anything. You can't do anything with it. But what I would like is to, instead of just saying no, AI is the devil, it is for everyone again to be a bit curious and start learning more about AI. What is it? What can it do? I mean, if we would start with some kind of small AI project in courts, what could it be? Could we start getting to know the technology in some kind of administrative procedure that would really help us and not be dangerous or controversial at all? Because this almost is, it's a little bit about like this discussion I mentioned earlier with online trials and sexual abuse cases or a rape trial, why do we have to talk about AI and judging, which is like the most complicated and controversial discussion? Can't we start by discussing what AI can do and how it can help us in processes that don't have much to do with the judging yet? Just to learn more about the technology, and because I see a big risk in not participating at all, just saying no to something. No, this is dangerous. We're not going to do this, because then again you're left outside. You don't learn anything. You just resist and you say no. So I don't believe in saying no. I believe in being curious.
Yeah. So maybe.
Yeah, small steps.
I'm sure it will come.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Just a matter of time.
True.
And our mindsets and attitudes towards using more technology change all the time.
Yeah.
Many public authorities use artificial intelligence in kind of when they prepare decisions. I know that the Finnish tax authority, at least, they kind of gather information and analyze it using, at least it's a partly automated system or even artificial intelligence to make the taxation decisions to people.
Yep.
Because there's still after that, there's a chance that you can correct if something went wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's really important that you can do that, because What's not very good is that when you haven't tried your AI solution, but you just launch it anyway, and then the citizens are being subjected to this solution that you don't really know what it does, and then it doesn't turn out very well, and you can't explain why it did like it did, and everyone is furious, which is basically what seemed to have happened in Gothenburg, I think last summer, with the placement of kids in various schools, and that was very sort of criticized in media, how the municipality had handled their magic AI solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
testing should be part of the process.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the crucial questions with using AI in legal decision making, that you have to be able to go back to and go through how the decision was made. But as I've understood with AI, it's not always possible, that you don't really know how it formulated the outcome. And that's the problem.
Yeah, and there's no traces.
Yep. It's been great to talk to you, Andrea. I think we are soon to finish our list of topics with you. Time flies when you're having fun. To summarize our discussion, how could other courts or courts in general start applying design thinking in their daily work? Where to start, for example?
Well, I think you can learn a lot by just applying these mindsets. And for example, one of my things that I always bring up when I talk about legal design is this question of knowing you're solving the right problem. And that's also so extremely basic, but it's so basic that people forget that very often in their daily life and in their work life. And the mindsets are, for me, they are a very suitable first step. And start experimenting and leaning into change instead of resisting change. And I also very much believe in asking people who have tried this before, and you know, reaching out, have you done this? How did you solve it? What were the benefits? What were the what obstacles did you find when you did it? So I really hope that courts and the whole judicial industry will continue to grow an interest in legal design, because there's still so much to learn and do.
Yep.
We think that you have done something very important for the legal design movement through your work in the court system. What has this journey as a legal designer in courts taught to you, Andrea?
I don't consider myself being a legal designer. No, because I've learned much, and I have become quite humble too, I think, for example, to the thing that I mentioned earlier, that change really takes time, and it's okay to be impatient, but you still have to realize that's just the way it is. And I have learned that you come a long way by being enthusiastic and if you can succeed in inviting people to come along with you on your journey or on your project, then that's very important, I think. And I have also learned that it's very rewarding and important to communicate what you're doing. I mean, if I would just have done what I've done and not saying anything about it in social media, I would not be having this discussion with you. I would not have been at the Legal Design Summit. I wouldn't be anywhere, basically. So social media and communicating the what you're passionate about is really important. And there you will also find lovely people that are interested in the same things as you are. And that's fantastic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on the communication part. It makes the difference.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrea, for being our guest. It was really inspiring to talk to you.
Thank you, Henna. And thank you, Nina. It was great being here.
Thank you for listening to the Legal Design Podcast. For more information about us, please visit legaldesignpodcast.com. You can also follow us on our social media accounts on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn.